Hello, everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life. Because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. It's true. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the wonderful Pacific Northwest Writers Association. They've been supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. They have a great writers' conference every year, every summer, down here in the Puget Sound area, Western Washington. And we also, the PNWA also has a very good writing contest that includes genres of all kinds, from romance to poetry to memoir to nonfiction to literary fiction, suspense, you name it. I think there's about 14 or 15 different categories. It's a great way to get feedback from quality readers, and should you be one of the winners, a few careers have started from that particular contest. That is going now. We are taking submissions, so if you're interested in that contest, go to PNWA.org, PNWA.org. I should say also, if you listen to this show, you've probably heard a few of my Fearless Writing Masterclasses, I call them. And if you've enjoyed those and you live in the Seattle area, I will be teaching a Fearless Writing Workshop this Saturday, February 18th, in the Seattle area. 4-hour workshop. We get into how to get into the frame of mind where writing is possible. How do you get over all those fears that hold you back from the writing experience you know you are meant to have? Again, that's this Saturday from 1 to 5 in the Seattle area. If you have any questions, go to my website, williamknauer.com. You'll find all the information about it. Well, today's guest, I'm very glad to have him on the show. He is following in the line. Recently, I've been having a few publishers slash writers on, but Jason's a little different. Jason Rykulik is first and foremost, the publisher, not just an editor at, but the publisher of Quirk Books. You may or may not have heard of Quirk Books, but they are famous for, among other things, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which I think took a lot of people by surprise, but just exploded, and then the YA fantasy novel series, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, a wonderful series, which of course got turned into a movie and which spent 5 years on the New York Times bestseller list. Well, Jason has stepped out from behind his editor's and publisher's desk and written his own novel, the very readable, the very entertaining, and tender coming-of-age novel, The Impossible Fortress. And he's here to talk to us today about all the different hats he wears. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Jason, you busy man. So you started your own little publisher, and it did okay for itself.
Well, 17 years in the making, so.
Yeah, you know, an overnight success.
Right, exactly.
Well, so it's interesting. I'm reading, of course, the character in the protagonist in the, or the narrative. It is, you know, it's one of these funny things. Sometimes I can't remember if I'm reading in the first, yes, it's in the first person. The narrator is a bit ambitious and a bit of an entrepreneur in The Impossible Fortress. What made you decide to try and start your own publishing house? That's a big task to take on.
Sure. Well, you know, the company was actually started by a friend of mine, and when he was getting it off the ground, he was looking for an editor, and so I was sort of like a founding editor. I teamed up with him from the start.
Right.
You know, it's funny.
And was
it
just the two of you, really? And maybe was it the whole publishing house basically you and him?
It was me, him. He had an assistant, and we had a designer who. It was four people in a room.
Okay. Yeah.
That
sounds about right.
But when I was a kid, you know, it's funny. So my dad was a construction worker, and I loved books. I loved writing. I loved telling stories, but. You know, I thought working in publishing would be impossible. I thought that was like trying to work in the White House or, you know, be an astronaut. I just thought you'd have to have connections, you know?
Right,
and
of course.
So what happened was I discovered computers as like home computers were just starting to take off. And I saw how you could sort of put text on the screens and manipulate that text. And I just sort of fell in love with that. And I started writing on computers I'd write these long prefaces to my video games where I would like to talk about the history of these characters.
Right.
And I thought
right.
I would have my own video game company. That was my aspiration. I was like, I'm going to have my own software yeah. company because I loved all the autonomy you had over these little mini video games. It's all very similar yeah. to what I do now, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. So you did come at it from you were independently minded around your creative life. It sounds like you were looking for autonomy.
I think that's right. Yeah. I mean, I've always yeah. you know, I worked in New York publishing for a little bit, and it just did not work out well for me. You know?
No. Oh, why is that?
No. You know, I mean, well, you know, if you go in, as I did, right out of school, and, you know, you get paired with an editor, and sometimes that's a match made in heaven because you find, like, the perfect mentor who's, like, completely
right.
aligned with your taste, and then sometimes you don't.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And we just, you know, I mean, I tried my best, but, like, it was not a good relationship, and I felt like I came away from that experience thinking, well, this is just not for me. Like, I'm not good at this.
Right.
I wasn't really putting the blame on him. I was putting the blame on myself because I was young and sort of insecure, and I didn't really know. And
right.
so I kind of didn't really have any choice except to sort of do something, you know, on my own.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because doing it the traditional way wasn't working.
Well, see, you had the perfect failure to bring
yeah.
you into what you were supposed to be doing. Life can be
right.
kind
no,
that
exactly.
way, but.
Exactly.
But it just doesn't feel that way at the time. And so I assume you and your friend with whom you started the book had similar aesthetics. Did you have a little vision for what you wanted, or did you just know you wanted to publish books? Or do you think,
we want to publish the kind of books,
damn it, that we read, whatever that is.
Well, here's
is.
The challenging thing, right? You know, you're trying to start a company. You have no money. You have no brand
right.
identity. You have no name. So where are you going to get the stuff from? You know, there's this perception
right.
that, oh, the world is full of great unpublished manuscripts, and they only just need to be found. And, man, talk to anybody who's actually – on my side of the desk, that is, you know, those books are really hard to find.
Yeah.
And so what we did was, you know, out of desperation, we're like, well, we can come up with concepts that are so sort of outrageous that, you know, the author will matter, but it won't be the key selling point. You know, most books, the author's name is in, like, giant type, like the bestsellers
right.
you see. In our books, what we were selling was sort of the concept, the sort of, like, outrageous premise of the book itself. An early success was this book called The Worst Case Scenario Survival Handbook.
I remember. Oh,
so
that
like,
was you guys. Okay, sure.
Yes, yes.
Yep.
And that, like, told people how to, like, escape from quicksand and fight a crocodile, you know?
And so did you come up with the idea and then find the writer for it?
Well, David Borgnick, the guy I told you who started the company, that was his idea. And,
I see, okay.
And he found the writer. And that was one of our early books. And then we just continued doing books in that vein.
Right.
One I talk about all the time because it's just so absurd is, and yet we sold tons of it, is a book called Crafting with Cat Hair. It was a Japanese bestseller. It was a bestseller in Japan. They take the hair of a cat, they iron it into a kind of felt, and then you use it to make more cats. Like you make like these little cat finger puppets and ornaments and things like that. So
how did you come up with – okay. All right.
Well, you know, we just saw it, you know, and we're like, yeah, let's translate
right.
that in English. We'll sell tons of it. And sure enough, of course we did, you know.
Wow.
And so we were doing that kind of stuff for a real long time, these nonfiction sort of impulsy books. You'd see them like in Urban Outfitters down in the basement.
Yeah.
I always wanted to move into fiction, but people kept saying, you know, it's too hard. You can't really do it. And I was trying to think of a way to do it in a way that would feel on brand for who we were. And that was the big, that's sort of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies grew out of that impulse.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
I didn't need a big name author. I just needed somebody who could add zombies to the Jane Austen novel. And, however, that guy, Seth Graham Smith, who took the job, back when he was an unknown, writer this weekend, he had the number one movie in America because he wrote the screenplay for the Lego Batman movie. So,
he did? Oh, my
so
God.
That book launched a really nice career for him, and that's probably why there's a blurb from him on my novel. Because,
yeah, I noticed that. How nice for you.
He's a nice guy, and he remembers what happened.
So before we get to your book, I just want to double back to something for some of our listeners to, if they might have missed it, because I do think that it's sometimes useful to hear folks talking about life and publishing from the other side of the desk, because most writers only know it from their end. And that was something you said, which is that that publishers are also are as hungry for that great novel as I think writers are hungry for that great break. In other words, you're both in a way looking for the same thing. You may not match, but it's not like publishers see themselves as holding all the cards. They need great books in order to have a publishing house. Is that a fair?
Absolutely.
I mean, the psychology. I think it's easy for a writer to give editors and publishers a life and a psychology that isn't really true to what they're going through in trying to build their business.
Yeah, absolutely. And most of them are we are like as hungry as any writer. You know, you're constantly looking. It's particularly the younger editors. You know, like the assistant editors, the associate editors. That's how you advance your career. You need a book to
find that. Yeah.
And you know, I mean, the sad truth is, like, you know, being good is not enough. It needs to be saleable.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like, you need to be able to connect that book to an audience of readers, which is what I think most writers want. But that can be the tricky part.
Well, I think also you have to, you know, I think of my friend Garth Stein, who wrote the book The Art of Racing in the Rain.
Oh, sure.
And
yeah.
That's narrated by a dog. And his agent said, no one will buy it. And he showed it to a dozen agents, and they said, no one will buy this. This is crazy. It's narrated by a dog. And then he found an agent who said, I know I can sell this. And he sold it for a lot of money. Because he understood the value of it. So I think you have to find a great book, and you also have to find a great book that you – like I could – if someone had said, we should write a book called Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, I would have had trouble. I thought, oh, that's just too kooky. But I couldn't see it, you see. I heard that
from many, many people.
Well, sure. But you see, you understood why there was a market for it where someone like me would not have understood it. So I think it's not just it being saleable. You have to – you, the editor – the publisher, even the agent, has to understand why it's saleable. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
Because what's saleable to
one
person is not saleable to another.
Anyway, and it comes down to taste, too. I mean, people have to just like it, you know, because it's hard to get it in. What you need to do, the most important thing, I think, as a publisher, as an editor, is just enthusiasm. You have to be the world's biggest cheerleader for this book. And it's hard to do that with something you don't love, you know? And so
writers shouldn't take it so personally when an agent or an editor says, I just don't love it, because it's really true that they're not the best fit for it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You do not want to work with that person if they don't love it. They're not going to be your best advocate.
That's right.
You know, when I was trying to sell my book, my agent sent it out to 20 editors on one day, and he just sent it out.
Yeah.
And
nine
of them and were interested in it. But 11 didn't like it, you know, or for whatever reason chose not to pursue it.
Right.
And, you know, if I didn't have that agent, if I was just approaching editors one at a time, and I approached those 11 editors first, you know what I mean? I would have had 11 rejections before I got to one person who saw in it what I saw in it, you know?
Right.
That's
a really good point.
Do
you feel like you found the right editor for it over at Simon Schuster?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I have their editor in chief, Mary Sue Rucci, and she's amazing, and she, you know, the luxury of talking to her before she actually bought the book. So
that's nice.
You know, then you know what you're getting into, and I knew it was going to be a perfect fit.
Well, so all right, but so here you are. You're a publisher of these books. You're having the publisher is. You've built it up and it's doing great, but you decide you're going to take this other journey. Now, had the idea of writing your own original novel been sitting in your heart for a while, or how did this come about?
Well, so, you know, this may be a result of just me working at Quirk. I have a lot of ideas, and a lot of the ideas, because we still don't get that many submissions from New York. So a lot of the ideas are sort of conceived in-house, and I find people to write them. And I've been writing probably 20 years easily, just on my own stuff. I have like 4 books under my bed that I sort of reached the end of, and I was just sort of not, you know, either reached the end of or just sort of abandoned. You know, I was like, this isn't working.
Right.
And this was a story that, you know, because I was drawing a lot from autobiography and my early experiences with computers and things like that, I was like, well, I can never commission this. I'm not going to hire someone to do this. I wrote this one myself, and when I finished it, I was like, okay, actually, I feel pretty good about this one.
So you had written 4 that you did not even try to find an agent for or do the usual thing for?
Never showed them to. I don't think my wife has even seen all of them. I think
there were
2 that were so bad I just didn't even show them to her.
Now, did you write in the genre? Did you write something more? Were the other books? Because this is, you know, this is in the real world. Did you write stuff that was more fantastical in the earlier versions? In the other books?
Yeah, I was trying all different kinds of things. I wrote like a book that nowadays would be categorized as like domestic suspense, kind of like a Gone Girl sort of book. I wrote a fantasy novel, you know, but like, it was bad. I don't know what. Well, actually, I do know. There's 2 things I did differently with this one, and I think they have something to do with why I was happy with it. One is that I was pulling from autobiography in a way that I hadn't before.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that's something to it. The other thing that I did is this is the first book that I outlined from the beginning. I outlined the whole thing.
Oh, you outlined
just thinking about it.
Yeah.
And I never tried that before. I always thought, oh, that's like the least creative way to write. You know, I'm just going to write. I'm going to take the impulse and just start from there. And like, and you know, you hear some people talk about like that's writing from the inside out as opposed to writing from the outside in.
Mm-hmm.
And man, I'll tell you, that outline, once I
made the difference
that,
for you,
huh? What all the beats were, and I felt really good about it. Writing this book was a breeze. It was like the happiest 2 hours of every day for 2 years. You know.
Now I'll tell you, this is perfect. This confirms everything I know about the outline, which is this. If you are an outliner, you must outline. And if you are not an outliner, do not outline. There are those for whom the outline frees them, and there are those for whom it kills them. And there's no, you know, there's no one way or the other. But if you are an outliner, everyone I know who is and who has not, who's tried writing a book without them, was just so glad when they found the outline. It just solved so many problems for them.
Man, I'll tell you, I tell that story to any writer I see who's struggling because it worked for me. It doesn't work for everybody,
right?
But
no,
it worked for me.
I couldn't do it.
Yeah,
I wouldn't be able to do it. But I know enough people who do to understand that if that is the way, if you need that mentally, it just, if for some reason it frees something up, it helps you relax in some way.
Yeah.
You know. Well, that is now. Although I assume, well, I don't know. I don't know how detailed your outline was, but I assume that. In the act of writing, maybe not, but usually the people I know, even those who outline and love the outline, there's still these surprises that pop up as they go. Is that the case
for
you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a whole, I mean, yeah, big chunks of the book, you know, were sort of not clear to me when I started, and even the ending. I knew like 80% of the book. You know, lots of things came into focus while I was writing it, and I moved things around, and, you know, little structural changes here and there. So,
let me ask you this. When you're outlining...
You know, I'll tell you, what didn't change,
no, go ahead.
Was where the characters started and stopped. That always remained constant. So, like, the plotty stuff changed a little bit, but I knew where I wanted the characters to begin and end, and that always stayed fixed. And I think that was really the through line for me.
You mean their arcs were going to begin and end?
Yes, right.
Exactly. Where they were going to appear and where they were going to leave and so on?
Yeah.
Ah, so that stayed constant. Now, I've always wondered this about outliners, which is, in terms of characters, I could not really picture a character until I had them start talking. And then I'd say, oh my God, there they are. But I could never really picture them in my, without going and meeting them on the page and seeing how they walked around and stuff. So did you have – how did you understand the characters from that – the distance of the outline?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know that I fully did. You know, I think I had to do some of what you're talking about, you know.
Yeah.
But I guess I felt like I understood them enough.
Did you base them loosely on certain people?
Yeah, that's what I was just about to say. Like, I was writing about very familiar people, you know, people I grew up with, people like I sort of knew. Just, you know, I feel like these people are part of my DNA. I'm from New Jersey, you know? And so I feel like I could write about these characters in my sleep. It's about the easiest kinds of people to write about for me. You know, I mean, if I had to write about a character in, I don't know, Dallas, Texas or something like that, you know, it'd be...
I will tell you, Jason, book, these characters are so realistic. They felt so there was there's a certain kind of detail that is brought to the way, particularly those three friends interact with each other, our three main, that is so particular, that felt so, I mean, I knew it wasn't memoir, but had that quality to it almost of that is, I don't even know how to put my finger on it, but it felt so true to the way boys actually deal with each other, really deal with each other. As opposed to how we want them to deal with each other, or it felt so. You had enough of a memory of that because that felt very real to me.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, and you know, it's funny. Some people have a tough time with that. You know, I mean, I see some of the posts about the book, and people don't like the way the boys are talking to each other. But like, I was trying to do like an honest representation of. That's how I remember it being.
Right.
In the 80s, when I was 14. I don't know what boys are like nowadays. They take their phones and they go into their rooms, and I have no idea what they're thinking.
Right. Well, but it's funny. You're really writing about a group of people who are the precursors to this digital, to my children, who are fully digitized, so to speak. But really, you were writing about, because I'm a little older than you, so there was a little less of what you were describing in terms of being able to program stuff out of your house. There was one guy I knew who's dad was a professor who could program this ancient computer back in 1982, but there wasn't that much of it. The boys you were describing in particular, as well as the girl, but are just on the cusp of what was really coming in a way. They were glimpsing what the world was about to become in a lot of ways. They were the forerunners of it.
Yeah.
If that's fair.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was a cool time to be doing all that stuff because the machines were so limited. One person could really do everything. You could have total autonomy. The way that I feel like I do have over, like, the books that I publish at Quirk, you know, I mean, I'm working with the author, but beyond that, nobody really tells me what to do.
Yeah.
And and that's what I loved about those early games. It's not like that anymore. Now, you know, these video games that you see on the Xbox, you have hundreds of people working on them. They have budgets in like the millions of dollars, tens of millions.
Yeah, they're like movies.
So exactly. They're just like movies. So,
although the indie game designer is still a thing, I believe.
Yes. No, it's true. There is like there's a whole community. You can go on websites like Steam and things like that, and people will, you know, 1 and 2 person game developers.
Yeah. It's a lot of work. They do it. So, all right, so here you've got this book, it's out, it's been out for a week, it just came out last Tuesday, I guess, and you're actually calling me from California because you're touring around. How has this experience been for, I know you've probably glimpsed it, and certainly you've seen books that you've conceived go out and have their time, but this is all just you conceiving it, you writing it, and now you're talking to people about it. How has that been going?
It's good. You know, it's funny. For years, you know, we send authors on tours, and they complain about how difficult it is. And I'm like, oh, give me a break, you know. You're in hotels. You know, you got somebody driving you everywhere, holding your hand. How hard can it be? But, man, I'm on day 8. I woke up with a cold and a sore throat.
Oh, really? And
you're
doing my show.
It's an endurance test, but I love it.
Is it?
You know, I mean, I'm thrilled to be out on the road. I mean, you could never complain about it. How could you complain about it? You know,
you almost did, but you because it's tiring.
I know.
It's tiring, but do you like meeting the people? Do you like going to the bookstores?
Here's the thing. I love talking to people about quirk books and authors I work with. I'm really comfortable doing that because I've been doing that for 17 years. Like I told you, I want to be the world's biggest cheerleader for all these authors. Talking about my own stuff is a new thing for me. So like I'm just getting used to it. I feel a little more
uncomfortable.
But you know, it's just a different, I can rave and rave about, you know, what's coming out from Quirk next fall all day long. You have to talk about your own stuff differently.
Here's what I would say about that. And I totally, you know, you're obviously a sweet guy and you're not someone who has made his way in the world as, for instance, our current president has by banging his own drum. However, one thing I do feel like, this is something I've learned from my own work and from talking to a lot of writers, is that you can honestly say you love this book. Doesn't mean you think it's the best book in the world, but you would not have, and I know you don't know what other people think of it, but you wouldn't have spent 2 years writing it if you didn't love it. And you can think about how happy you were for those 2 hours a day. And I think you're allowed to speak from that, honestly, without saying, and I'm the best writer that's ever walked this earth.
Oh, yeah. No, I totally agree with what you're saying. I mean, I do love the book. Like, I'm really happy with how it turned out. I don't think it's for everybody.
Good.
But I think there's a certain kind of reader who I know will enjoy it. You know, I mean, it seems to be right now, like, the consensus, the best reaction I get comes from people who are, like, Generation Xers like myself, you know, because they just they remember all this stuff. The book's like a nostalgia trip. It's meant to read, like, these 80s teen movies, you know. Like, that was sort of my benchmark. I wanted it to feel really fast and really funny. It's 75,000 words, which is not a short book, but people read it.
It is. It reads
really
fast. It reads really fast. And I will tell you, I too am like the very beginning of Generation X, and it does read like a nostalgia trip. It really does. It just reeks of that time, and in the best way.
Yeah.
Maybe reeks not the best word, but it absolutely does read like a nostalgia trip. So if anyone, but I actually think that younger readers could enjoy it too, honestly, because has adolescence really changed all that much, except that there's more porn available? Unlike your poor protagonists.
Yeah, I hope you're right. I mean, I want to think that's true. I think it's funny. One book that I had in the front of my mind while I was writing Impossible Fortress was this novella by Stephen King called The Body, which they made into the movie Stand By Me. And, you know, that book is just sort of like soaked with, you know, 1950s references, particularly the early chapters. And I remember reading that book when I was like 14 years old and not understanding any of these references. I didn't know what he was talking about, but those details all made it feel very convincing to me. And so it didn't really matter that I didn't understand any of the references. I believed I was in the 50s.
Right.
You know?
See, think of that. Hold that in mind when you're talking to the younger readers. Well, Jason, you poor man, you're ill and you've got more people to talk to tonight. So I'm going to let you go. But before I do, I want to throw one more question your way, and what I want you to do is I want you to finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what? What has it taught you, Jason?
Writing has taught me anything. What has it taught me? Holy moly. People always have good answers to this. People just like fire something out.
Sometimes they have really goofy answers, but most times they have pretty good answers, yeah. What's your gut? Taught you one thing. What is
my
it?
My gut is that there is, I have learned to take pleasure in the work itself. To me, that is like the biggest satisfaction. And that's what writing has taught. Writing for 20 years, like writing books that I just put under my bed, I enjoy it. Like, I like it, you know?
Right.
And I kind of don't, I mean, I always wanted to have a book published. And I like having books published, and certainly, you know, pays the mortgage, keeps the lights on, all that stuff. Like, it's good and it's essential. But to me, the ultimate satisfaction is like just doing the work. So
that is a good lesson.
I always try to remind people that if you don't like it, there's easier ways to make a living.
That's absolutely true. That's right. Enjoy the process. That keeps you in the present moment, Jason. Keeps you in the present moment. And that's where all life actually happens. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, and I wish you all the luck with this book, and I hope there are more to come afterwards.
Well, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you, Jason. Take it easy. Have a good rest of your book tour.
All right. Thank you. See ya.
Thank you. Yes, you know what? Jason was right. You got to love the work, and publishers got to love. What a perfect thing to talk about, it being Valentine's Day. It's love. Love. You got to love what you do. And then you find someone else who loved what you did, and that's how you find a publisher. That's how you do it. We'll be back again next week. I'm going to talk to the author and publicist, Lisa Martin. But until then, go find someone you love and spend a little time with them. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody.